I'm Sandy Fahler from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today is Thursday, April 6th, 2006. I'm interviewing Mary Anderson, professor in the Geology and Geophysics Department of UW-Madison. Dr. Anderson also holds appointments in the UW-Madison Geological Engineering Program and the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sandy.
Well, I'll start with our first question, and this goes back to where and when you were born. Describe your childhood and early schooling. Talk about any family members, teachers, or others who encouraged you in your studies.
I was born in Buffalo, New York in September 1948. I was an only child. My parents both were from Polish heritage, so I actually grew up in a strongly ethnic neighborhood in Buffalo, hard-working Polish neighborhood, and there was a lot of the Polish bakeries, a lot of Polish customs still, people were still practicing from the old country, especially in the church. It was a Catholic community, so I went to the Catholic grade school, which was right across the street practically from my house, and was taught by the Sisters of St. Francis there, had, I think, fairly typical childhood for that period of time. I then went to a private high school run by the Sisters of Mercy, and the tradition in Buffalo was that if your parents could all afford it, you went to a private high school, because the public high schools were thought to be not acceptable. So there were lots of, especially from the Catholic community, there were lots of Catholic private high schools. So this was an all-girls private high school, and I did get some tuition break because I took some sort of entrance exam, so I had a little bit of a tuition scholarship. But for most of it, my parents paid the tuition. I rode the city bus. There was a short ride on the city bus to get to the high school. And I guess, like most people, I didn't have a particularly good experience in high school. And I'm not sure it was the high school or it was just the time. But the one big highlight was that in my first year, the high school had an experiment, and they decided that they wanted to have us start taking the so-called Regents Exam in Earth Science. I don't know what it's like in New York State at present, but back then, you got two high school diplomas. One was the city diploma, or the diploma from the high school, and then the other one was a diploma issued by the state, the so-called Regents diploma. And in order to get the state diploma, you had to pass these Regents exams, and there was a whole series of Regents exams, and one of them was Earth Science exam. And for some reason, the sisters decided that they wanted to get into the business here of sending us taking this Earth Science exam. So they did before they made that decision, I'm sure they had the tradition also was to take the freshman class, which upset maybe some 200 girls. And we had all taken entrance exams in order to get into the high school in the first place. So we had grades on this entrance exam, and they divided us by intelligence or by how well we had done on this entrance exam. And the smart girls were in homeroom 1, and the not so smart girls down the line till you got to homeroom 6. And then they also structured the courses we took depending on that. The smart girls were all presumably going to go to high school, to college, so we took a different set of courses than the ones at home of 6, with things like typing and home ec and all that sort of stuff. So they decided, well, the smart girls here, we'll take them and have them take this earth science. We'll get them prepared to do the earth science exam. So for the first time ever, they had a class in earth science, which I took, and I enjoyed it enormously. Great fun. The teacher herself was kind of struggling through it and learning it, but she was the most memorable teacher I had in high school. Some of them were not very good at all, but this particular nun was really a remarkable teacher and a remarkable person. So I have great memories of her. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, I don't know, apparently we didn't do too well on the exam, or I'm not sure what happened, but they never repeated that experiment. So it was just that one year,
mm-hmm.
one class of like 30 girls who got this earth science experiment. It sort of changed the course of my life. Because I don't think I would have gone into geology had it not been for that memory, that good experience in high school. After that, I decided, I'd also been interested in music the whole time during high school, and I'd been taking piano from the sisters in high school, and I actually got it into my head that I wanted to be a music major. So that was my plan was, and my parents took me around, and we actually looked at several colleges looking at their music program. But
did they try to influence you at all?
Oh, yeah, I should mention my parents and all this. My parents were extremely supportive. My father had never finished, I don't think he ever even finished grade school. He certainly never went to high school. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure he finished eighth grade. A very hard childhood himself, growing up in a very, very rough circumstance. And being put to work early and just horrible. My mother actually finished high school, and she was working as a secretary, and then did that after I'd gotten out of grade school. She actually went back to work as a secretary just because she liked to work. We didn't mm-hmm. actually need the money, but she really wanted to have that kind of a profession. But they always had a great thirst for knowledge, especially my father. And there were always books all over the house. They were great lovers of the library. So we were always going to the library and checking books out of the library, their magazines and newspapers. And they were determined that I should have an easier life than they did.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very encouraging toward education because they realized that was the key to success in life. So they were just very, very supportive and encouraging in anything I wanted to do. And they really didn't try to guide me or pressure me or push me in any one direction. So when I wanted to do music, they thought, okay, that's fine. So we went and looked at various music schools, and I decided that to take some preparation, to get better prepared, I should take a summer course at the local university. It was at the University of Buffalo. And also by that point in time, I had decided that I wanted to stay in Buffalo for college. And the reason for this was mainly back in those days, and I guess maybe even still today, when you go away to college, you have to have a roommate and live in a dormitory. And being an only child, this thought was repulsive to me. I did not want to live in a dormitory with a roommate. If I had been able to live in a dormitory by myself, I might have gone away to college. Mm-hmm. But all the options we looked at made it clear that you would have two or three roommates in there. Now, this is awful. And I had this wonderful setup at home. Of course, I had my own room, and I had a separate little office, and two very supportive parents who catered to my needs here, and no siblings to interfere with anything. So I thought, okay, I'm gonna stay in Buffalo. And also, I had started working at the local library in high school, actually. I had gotten a job with the local library, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually toyed with the idea of being a librarian there at one point. And in college, I continued work with the local library system.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this nice part-time job all set up here, too. So it was just too tempting. And I like Buffalo. I like the city. I like the living environment. So I was going to stay at the University of Buffalo. So I took a summer course in music theory the summer before I was going to enter the University of Buffalo. And I was in there with real music majors. And they were, one of the things that you had to do as part of the testing procedures, they would play chords, and you had to identify what those chords were. And I could not hear that at all.
Oh.
Could not do that.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely could not. No matter how I tried, I couldn't teach myself to do that.
Hmm.
So I realized I just didn't have the ability, the innate talent to be a music major. And although I could play the piano fairly well, I didn't have what it took mm-hmm. to be a music major. So then I thought, what am I going to do? So I remembered my love of earth science in high school. I thought, okay, I'll try that.
Now, had you taken any other courses in high school in addition to that first one, or was that the only
one? That was the only course in earth science. Okay. Of course, I'd taken courses in biology and chemistry.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I don't think we had physics in high school. It was biology and chemistry and I had math, and mm-hmm. I liked all that.
Okay.
I liked all the sciences. I didn't, many of the courses in high school are not very good. I did not have a very good preparation in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing that the class actually did as well as it did in retrospect. Because when I compared experiences with others, like my husband, who went to a public high school in Dearborn, and some of his friends who actually went on to MIT, it seems like they got a whole lot better preparation
mm-hmm.
than I did.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the sciences were fairly good. The history and the English, those were, I thought, really, really weak, and maybe that was why I tended to gravitate
mm-hmm.
toward the science. But earth science was the only one I had taken. And of course, I had a little hobby, just like probably every kid does, collected rocks. And
okay.
Mm-hmm. and my parents had taken me around to some of the national parks on some of our vacations.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't any, somewhere along the line, I guess it was later, I'll tell you about that later, when
okay.
I got to college, there's another thing that influenced me.
Okay.
So
you got to, you just decided to go to SUNY Buffalo
yes.
then,
right? Yeah. SUNY Buffalo is actually its official name, and that's what it was called when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm told they want to be called University at Buffalo.
Oh.
So its official new name
mm-hmm.
is now University at Buffalo in sort of a subtitle. SUNY Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And the history of that is it used to be called University of Buffalo when it was a private college, and then it came under the state system and changed to SUNY at Buffalo, and now apparently they want to kind of more distinguish themselves.
Okay.
They call themselves University of Buffalo.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting.
But I had a wonderful experience there. That was one of the best years of my life. And I should also say, when I announced to the Good Sisters of Mercy at my high school that I wanted to major in geology, and then I was going to go to the University of Buffalo, they were horrified because most of the girls went on to a private Catholic college, and there were several of those in Buffalo and elsewhere in the nation that they were pushing, and very few people ever went on to the University of Buffalo. That was thought to be really a bad place. and to major in geology was very unladylike. Yes. So their little experiment backfired on them. I mean, I'll never forget the mentor I had, the person who was advising you on various colleges. She was just shocked and horrified about this. But my parents again were quite supportive. They didn't think anything of it. They thought this was fine.
Okay.
Didn't seem, at least if they had any worries, they didn't convey them to me.
Of course, you were going to be living at home.
I was immediately living at home,
right.
So they could keep an eye on
yeah,
me.
Yeah,
right.
Well, now, how was your undergraduate education financed?
Oh, I did win one of these Regents scholarships. There was
oh.
a Regents, I don't quite remember how that worked, but there must have been some kind of an examination we took to get a Regents scholarship to finance your college. And it did. That might have been another motivation for staying in state, because this
mm-hmm.
thing was only good in state, and it pretty much paid the whole tuition at the University of Buffalo.
Mm, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about any courses, any special memories you have of your undergraduate education. Any people that influenced you there?
Well, as I say, it was just a. From start to finish, it was a wonderful experience. I have really fond memories of my whole time at University of Buffalo and the geology department, which I landed in fairly quickly because
mm-hmm.
I had decided, the first day of my time at UB, I knew that I was going to be a geology major. That's what I thought I wanted to be. So I immediately linked up with the geology department, and there was a great group of professors there. I had a really good experience with them. And one in particular, I took a course in fluvial geomorphology, which is the study of river processes and the landforms that are created by rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the little textbooks we used was by a Japanese woman named Marie Morisawa. And it was a little paperback book And I, by that time, I had acquired a fascination with Japan. And I, it was partly through, I started to like opera, and I would listen to the Metropolitan Opera on the radio on the Saturdays, and there was this opera, Man and Butterfly, that I loved. I just loved Puccini and Man and Butterfly and the whole story of it. So I started to develop this fascination with Japan, and here was this book by a Japanese woman, and I suppose that there was a role model or something that triggered me, that women could do things like this. I suppose it was that book, because I didn't have any, except for the sisters back in high school, there were no women mentors during my whole undergraduate and my whole graduate career. I was very fortunate in having good male mentors, however, mm-hmm. and one of them was the man who taught the course in fluvial geomorphology. His name was Parker Coffin. And he took a great interest in me, and he was actually a glacial geologist, but it's not infrequent in a smaller department for glacial geologists to also teach the fluvial geomorphology course. So I was really more interested in the fluvial geomorphology. But he was a great friend, and he helped me not only through some of the science stuff, but he also helped me advise me about some various issues I was having, and he became quite a good friend. And he advised me that when I got time to thinking, well, what am I going to do next? He said, go west. You need a completely new experience. You've been here in Buffalo your whole life. All of your emphasis has been on the East Coast here, and all the stuff you've been studying has also been kind of focused on this. Eastern geology. You need to get a completely new experience and go west. So
again, there was the understanding was almost immediately that you would go on to graduate school.
Right, right. I had racked up a few awards while I was there at UV. I'd gotten almost a 4.0 average, except for this music theory course, and for a course in badminton. I think I got a C in badminton. So I'd had almost a 4.0 average. So and though they'd given me one of their best senior awards, mm-hmm. so it was sort of the top ranks of the class. Mm-hmm. So they were very encouraging to go to graduate school. So okay, I thought that was what I had to do. So I applied. I can't remember. I applied to Princeton, I know, mm-hmm. And also to Stanford and maybe elsewhere. But the professor at Stanford called me up on the phone, and that made the difference. And he was very nice guy on the phone, mm-hmm. and also very encouraging. Clearly wanted me to come. So they gave me some kind of a fellowship as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to go to Stanford, and my parents were pretty horrified at that because it was way across on the other side of the country. And my mother, especially my mother, when I look back, I didn't realize what was happening to her at the time, but she was, she started to act crazy, and mm-hmm. I couldn't really understand it. I mean, I do now, mm-hmm. her only child, who had never been out of her sight, was going off to the other side of the country. But they eventually, so the parting was traumatic, and actually difficult, and did not go well. And I basically I had acquired a car by that point in time, basically got in my car and left. And I took my boyfriend at the time along with me, which didn't go over too well with the parents. But I figured I needed somebody to help me to drive in case I got a flat tire or whatever. And he was all gung-ho to go and see the West and mm-hmm. see what it's like. So the two of us set out on this cross. And that was something you just didn't do back in those days in the early 70s. So my mother was all worried about my reputation and what would happen, et cetera, et cetera.
What about your father?
He was trying to maintain neutrality between us. He was clearly worried, but he was not going as insane as she was. He really didn't say much. He didn't say much at all about it.
Probably the best course.
Yeah, right. So I got in there. It was all patched up at Christmas time. I went in the late summer, And then by Christmas time, my mother had got over it, and I came back home for Christmas, and everything was okay again. At which time I broke up with the boyfriend. And he had found another woman, and I had found somebody else at Stanford by then. My future husband, actually, I had met very shortly after arriving at Stanford, and it was clear to me that this was the real thing, mm-hmm. Rather than the guy back in Buffalo. So we broke up at Christmas time.
Well, talk about the Stanford experience.
Yeah, so Stanford. So I got there intending to focus on fluid geomorphology, but the man who had called me up on the phone, my advisor, was actually in a different field altogether. And the fluvial geomorphologist was a famous old guy who was about to retire. But I did do a master's thesis in fluvial geomorphology, but it turned out it wasn't really what I thought it was going to be, at least as I experienced it at Stanford. And the guy who was retiring, he was kind of out the door and was old school and all that. And there was this vibrant new professor who was a fantastic human being. Well, so was the old retired guy. But the man whose specialty was hydrogeology, groundwater, was just a fantastic human being. And he was very supportive, encouraging, and kind of talked me into the fact that this was the new thing. This was the way of the future. Geomorphology was sort of has been there forever. Hydrogeology was really the hot new topic. This was where you could really make a mark.
Mm-hmm.
I decided so there was actually some period there where I thought I was going to quit after my master's degree. And he was trying to talk me into staying on for a PhD in groundwater hydrology. And I thought, no, I'm not sure I want that. And he said, well, you don't come to Stanford for a master's degree. The master's degree is a consolation prize. Mm-hmm. You know, we intended you to go on for a PhD, but I really wasn't sure that I was ready to do that. So I decided to get a job for the summer, and I went to LA where I had a job in consulting, and I absolutely hated it.
Was it in your field though?
It was in my field, mm-hmm. Yes, but I hated it. It was awful. I didn't like the 8-to-5 working environment and being told what to do and being in with a whole group of people that were, I didn't like the experience at all. So I actually quit early and eventually came back to Stanford and said, yes, this is what I want. I definitely want the PhD. I see that I'm not cut out for a job in mm-hmm. the consulting world, which is what I would have had to do with a master's degree. So I thought, well, academia is really more suited to my temperament.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to go ahead with the PhD. So then I decided to do a thesis under Erwin Remsen, who was my advisor then, my PhD advisor. And he had a thesis kind of all mapped out. He said, this would be the next piece in the research that I've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
This is the next thing that could be done. So why don't you take this and figure out how to do it? So I did, and I also took some courses in civil engineering. The way people in groundwater hydrology are really kind of interdisciplinary between geology and civil engineering. So many of the courses I took while at Stanford were in the civil engineering department. And I actually ended up getting an interdisciplinary degree in hydrology,
mm-hmm.
which was between the two colleges, mm-hmm. or between the two departments. And I met another good mentor in civil engineering. His name is Bob Street. And I took several of his courses, and he was on my PhD advisory committee. And we've still kept up a little bit. I hear from him occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
So I had two really good mentors at Stanford.
And talk a little bit about your research at Stanford.
It was a computer modeling. What my advisor was into was numerical modeling or mathematical modeling, using equations to predict how groundwater moves in the subsurface. And he had written one of the first textbook actually in this area.
Mm.
He had just published that with two of his former students, and it's still quite a well-known textbook today. So that was his field, and then that's what I became too, a groundwater modeler.
So did you have to go out in the field, or was that pretty much in the
much,
lab?
Pretty much a lab, yeah,
okay.
A lab experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if the program at Stanford was not well developed at that point. My advisor had only arrived there a few years earlier. And the program, I would fault the program for not giving me enough field experience, or any field experience for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
I did not have any field experience in hydrogeology. We did go out in the field and do some landslide work, and there was actually some plumage of morphology, but I didn't have good training in groundwater hydrology in the field, and I'm always, even to this day, deficient in that area. And I try to rectify it here at UW. I fortunately have a colleague here who's very adept at field work.
Mm-hmm.
So our students, and even before then, I linked up with people at the state survey who do field work to make sure the students here don't have that same big hole in their
sure.
background that I feel I do.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a computer modeling thesis, and that's to this day is what I do.
Okay, then what happened?
Okay.
Well, did you teach?
I did. I had this fellowship,
mm-hmm.
and I actually, they urged me to apply for yet another fellowship from the California. I also had a Regents thing, so I got yet another fellowship from the California, state of California. But so I didn't have to teach, but
mm-hmm.
I felt I wanted to.
Sure.
So I asked for one semester I could be a teaching assistant, and I hated it, absolutely hated it. So I was very sorry I asked for that. I didn't. And it's sort of like, I guess, all academics are just thrown in, and you're assumed that you know what you're doing and how to do it, and you're not given any training or guidance on how to be a teacher.
Sure.
And I didn't have that ability, and I still don't, actually. I think it's a gift.
Mm-hmm.
You're born with a gift of knowing how to teach, and it's very you can certainly acquire some skills and talents
mm-hmm.
to get you through. But I think the truly great teachers are born with that innate ability to know how to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have it, I still don't have it, and I certainly didn't have it at Stanford. So I was not a good TA, and I did not enjoy it, and I only did that the one semester. So
you received your PhD.
So I actually, by that time, of course, I met my husband-to-be,
mm-hmm.
and who was in chemistry, is still in chemistry, he's a physical
mm-hmm.
chemist. And he had been there for 2 years at Stanford by the time I arrived.
As a student.
Mm-hmm. As a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
So after 3 years, after the 3 years that I had been there, he'd been there 5 years. So he was ready to graduate.
Sure.
I probably shouldn't have graduated with a PhD in 3 years. That was way too short. But
pretty
somehow
impressive.
I managed to do it, and my professors let me through. I'm not sure if I had been that professor, I would have let me through at that point, but they did. And so we did get our PhDs in 1973, and we were also married earlier that year. We were married in May, and then we both graduated in August. And we had a small wedding in Stanford, and the parents and immediate family actually came to Palo Alto. So we were married in Palo Alto. And we also invited several professors and mentors there.
Mm-hmm.
So then came time, okay, we've got our PhDs, what are we going to do next? And my husband Charles had already lined up a postdoc at Stony Brook in Long Island,
mm-hmm.
State University of New York at Stony Brook. So I started applying for various jobs up and down Long Island, and I eventually landed a part-time adjunct position at Southampton College of Long Island University.
Mm-hmm.
So we lived in a place called Wading River, and Charles would commute west to Stony Brook, and I would go east to Southampton, where I taught courses in stratigraphy and sedimentation. Things that were not in my immediate specialty area, but were general geology courses that I ought to know something about.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually I did get to teach a course in hydrogeology as well. And this was a small private college with a very small earth science faculty. But it was a good teaching experience. I was not a good teacher. But I at least got to get some experience there, and I kind of shuddered to think what it must have been like for the students there, but it was a good experience for me. And also, there was a man at the college who was interested in groundwater work, and he had been doing some consulting on the side. So he got me involved in consulting for the town of Southampton on saltwater intrusion problems. And I kind of look at that whole 2 years at Southampton as kind of as a continuation of my PhD, or even as a postdoc. But it was, you know, I should have been in school somehow for 5 years. And this was, I wasn't technically in school, but it was part of a learning experience. And it turned out that Long Island is just a classic laboratory for groundwater work. Some really famous work on groundwater had been done there, and it's still being done there. So it was a wonderful place. I didn't know this at the time, but it was a wonderful place for me to be because I got a completely new look at important groundwater problems dealing with saltwater intrusion. So that was just really turned out to be a fantastic experience for me.
Just backing up, what was the name of the community that you lived in?
It was called Wading River.
What kind of community was that? It's just...
It was hardly a community at all. It was a string of summer cottages, basically, and it was a rural road where there were a bunch of houses and summer cottages, and there was a post office. But that was basically it. Really wasn't even a town. It was kind of a Long Island itself is a whole strange environment.
That's why I was kind of curious about, you know, where, you know, what that was like living there.
The biggest town, I can't even think of the name of it now, but the biggest main town was a few miles away. And that's where you actually had some civilization, where you had food stores and shopping malls and that sort of thing.
Okay. All right, so those 2 years went by.
Yes.
And then?
And then, let's see now.
That would have been 75? Oh, yeah.
So we both, yeah, it was 75, yeah, okay. Exactly. So we both decided... Charles's postdoc was up, and we said, okay, we'll both start looking for jobs, and whoever gets the best job, the better job, that's where we'll go. So Charles started applying, and he went off for interviews, and I started applying, and I went off for interviews, and I got the interview here at Wisconsin. And I had never heard of the program before. I was only vaguely aware of the existence of the University of Wisconsin. I was only vaguely aware of Wisconsin was on the map, because I'd been on the East Coast, and I'd been on the West Coast, and there was this big void in the middle. So I mean, the first thing we did was, okay, where is it in the map exactly? Where is Madison? But I went for the interview, and it went very well. And I was very impressed, and I guess they were impressed with me. And the very first, well, one of the first things they asked about was my husband. It was actually a surprise, because at some of these other places I'd been interviewing, I would tentatively mention, well, I have a husband who's a PhD, and of course he'll need a job too. And their response was, well, that's not our problem. We're not interested in hearing about that. That's your problem. And Wisconsin was totally different. They immediately wanted to know what he did, and they rustled up somebody over in the chemistry department who did something similar. Put Charles in touch with this man, and by the time they had offered me the position here, they had also found a postdoc position for him. And this was, of course, well before any spousal hire stuff.
Yeah.
So I was very impressed by that. And also, during my interview here, I was very impressed by the ambiance in the department, and also there was a reception for me afterwards. And at the reception, there were people from all over campus. It was not just the department, but it's people who had water interests all over campus. And it was stressed that Wisconsin was very much interested in interdisciplinary interaction, and that all of these various people were drawn together through a common interest in water, and groundwater particularly. Mm-hmm. And they all knew each other, obviously, and they were on good terms, and I thought, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
So
I have to admit, I didn't know that was happening back in
75. Back in 75, yeah, 75. Yeah. So I came here in 75,
So I really can't ask you what was your impression before you came, because you weren't even sure
where we were. And you know, those days, it actually wasn't, there weren't a whole lot of jobs to be had.
Uh-huh.
Charles didn't have a huge pick of stuff.
Sure.
And neither did I, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the salary was like $13,000 or something, which we thought was a huge, $13,500, I think was my starting salary, with no startup package. You know, you just came for the salary. And here now we have to pay, you know, really competitive salaries. We give them huge startup packages and lighter teaching loads, and none of that. I mean, we were just glad to have a job at that point.
Now, were there other women on the faculty at that time?
At that time, there were not. No.
What about at this reception? Did you meet other women that were interested in?
Gosh, I don't think I did. No. There were spouses were there.
Okay.
The various spouses.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think there were any women, no.
That didn't
and
worry
that,
you
that
at
did,
all?
No, that didn't bother me, because there I'd always had such good mentors in men.
Mm-hmm.
And in all my graduate work, too, I've been dealing mainly with male colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not at all put off not to see any women.
What about in your classes at Stanford and at, in your graduate or your undergraduate and graduate work, were there other women students?
In the geology specialty courses, there were very few. There were some who were in the science education, who took geology as part of their education. They were going to get degrees that would allow them to teach in the high school.
Sure.
So there were a couple of them working on that.
Mm-hmm.
But no, there weren't any women. In fact, when I there was the requirement for geologists back in at UB that you go to a field camp, a summer field camp. And the University of Buffalo actually did run its own field camp. But the way they ran it is they camped out.
Mm-hmm.
They had sort of a traveling caravan, and they would camp out, and they would go from spot to spot, and you would look at the geology and map the geology and analyze the geology. But you had to set up camp, and you had to cook your own meals, and you had to live in a tent. And they said, gosh, we don't want you to go on that as the only woman. If there were one other woman, it'd be okay.
Uh-huh.
But we don't want you there as the only woman.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you go somewhere else to the field camp? So I went to the University of Indiana field camp, which was held in Montana, but they had a permanent facility there. They had Quonset huts. And they had people from all over the country come, and with many women. So actually that, I forgot to mention that. That was mm-hmm. another pivotal experience for me. That was the first time I had seen Western geology. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I'd actually met women geologists. And there was a whole bunch of them here mm-hmm. at this field camp. So it was the first time I'd actually been away from home
mm-hmm.
on my own mm-hmm. for a whole summer. So for many reasons, that was just a glorious experience. I had a wonderful time. I was not good at field geology. And it was, again, sort of my same thing as music theory.
Mm-hmm.
It was something I just could not master. I could not see the rocks properly.
Mm-hmm.
I had a hard time just physically in the field keeping up with people. But it was a really wonderful experience
mm-hmm.
just to see all that and to be experiencing all these new ideas and new people.
Sure.
So that was where I met other women,
mm-hmm.
But in my own, and even in Stanford too, there weren't any women on the faculty or among my student colleagues,
mm-hmm.
all male colleagues.
Okay. What is the national reputation of the Department of Geology and Geophysics
today?
Right
now we're always worried about that in rankings, and mm-hmm. the recent rankings just came out, and the categories are a little strange, but we did place ninth. In earth sciences. Now, I'm not sure what earth sciences includes according
mm-hmm.
to that ranking. I mean, technically it would include geography
mm-hmm.
and maybe some of the stuff over in oceanography, but we're ranked ninth. And we're also ranked 11th in geochemistry. And a few years ago, one of these rankings came out with a hydrogeology specialty, and we were ranked second.
Whoa, that's great.
Right behind Stanford.
Oh,
yes.
My.
Yes. So, and the sedimentology program was also ranked fairly high, I think mm-hmm. second or third mm-hmm. in that ranking. So I think right now we have a very good reputation yeah. overall.
What is it best known for?
Probably those two. Well, I'm not sure. I actually mm-hmm. don't know. The geochemists have been working very hard to build up the geochemistry program, and they would probably like you to believe that it's best known for geochemistry. And the fact that they did place 11th now, which is pretty good, mm-hmm. in geochemistry in this ranking, may mean that their campaign to increase the visibility and the reputation of the geochemistry program is working.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think that we're pretty tops in terms of hydrogeology. We have a colleague here who's in hydrogeology. And also my former students have gone out and populated the Wisconsin Geological Natural History Survey and the U.S. Geological Survey Office mm-hmm. in Middleton. So they have very strong programs now in hydrology, and we interact with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just that it's the two of us here, but we also have this expertise
sure.
In the city. And they all have adjunct appointments in the department and work on some of our research projects.
Mm-hmm.
So when you supplement our program with all of their resources,
right.
we actually have a pretty powerful program in hydrogeology.
Yeah.
So I'd like to think that we're best known for hydrogeology.
Well, good. Can you talk about the facilities in which you work? I mean, I know the building.
Yes.
And I know there's a new addition.
Yes.
Did that affect your work at all, the new addition?
Not so much. We don't need a whole lot to do hydrogeology.
Mm-hmm.
The chemists do need a lot of space, and they need a lot of fancy equipment. What my colleague and I, Jean Barr, need are computer resources
mm-hmm.
and also field equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had enough money to garner field equipment, and we can also use some of the field equipment from the State Survey and the USGS.
Mm-hmm.
So we share a lot of that stuff. There's also a program in engineering, the Geological Engineering Program, and there's a geophysicist there who has some equipment we borrow. So we've through this interdisciplinary network, we've been able to manage with the field aspects of things. And computers are pretty cheap now, so
mm-hmm.
we've been able to get a very nice computer lab set up, a hydro computer lab. And that happened, we've been years struggling with space issues. So I guess indirectly the new building did help us because it freed up space for others
mm-hmm.
so that we could acquire some of the older space actually
mm-hmm. okay.
for to expand our laboratory, our teaching laboratory. And also we lost a geomicrobiologist, her name is Jill Banfield, famous. Yes,
mm-hmm.
and I was actually chair of the department during that time. But she ended up going to Berkeley. And she had a whole room for her postdocs, fairly sizable room for her postdocs. So Jean and I said, okay, we want that for our computer lab. So we got that space and we got money for computers in there. So that was actually a dream come true for me because we've been always struggling
mm-hmm.
In a very small space with very old computers. So when we really finally set up a real hydro computer lab, that pretty much addressed all my desires. That's what I really needed
mm-hmm.
and wanted.
Well, that's good.
So we kind of work on what others look at as a fairly shoestring budget. The funding, we don't really get huge grants from NSF and all these big federal agencies. There's a funding agency in the state of Wisconsin called the Groundwater Research Advisory Council, and they fund proposals for a research assistant, basically.
And that's state funds then? Is that what?
It's state funds. It's state money.
Mm-hmm.
And they will fund a research assistant plus a few thousand for expenses. And we've been very successful in getting research assistance funded that way. And Jean's also gotten a lot of money with other researchers, other state agencies, kind of tagged along on funding with that. I've been tagging along on a NSF-sponsored project out of the Center for Limnology. It's headed up by Steve Carpenter,
mm-hmm.
who's a professor in zoology and also director of the Center for Limnology. But this, in the 1980s, there was this program at NSF to fund various sites around the U.S. to study long-term ecological processes. And we've had this funding since the early 80s. And the idea is that if you're funded for 2 or 3 years, you look at processes and you can't really tell what's happening. You can't really see any trends.
Mm-hmm.
Or any trends you do see could be misinterpreted because you're only seeing this small little window
sure.
of a very large picture. So NSF was sold on this idea that we need to study these longer term changes. So we've had this grant, and I've been one of the co-PIs since the beginning. And all our work has been focused now, all my work has been focused on the Trout Lake Basin in Vilas County,
mm-hmm.
which is the site of this long-term ecological research program that's been funded by NSF. So we've got a field-based program there, and then we can use that as a laboratory to develop and use our models
mm-hmm.
and study processes, study groundwater lake systems and wetland systems using modeling applications.
So are there students up there all year round?
No, there is a permanent field station up there with a director of the Trout Lake Lab who stays there all year round.
Okay.
And he has some support staff with
mm-hmm.
him that stay all
Can we just back up a little bit and talk about the tenure process
yes,
here?
Yes.
Talk about your experience going through that.
Well, the department had a very bad experience with tenure just before I came, and it pretty much tore the department apart. I still am unclear as to exactly what happened during that time, but it was so bad. Nobody wanted to even talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was so bad. And so I've sort of pieced together what it was all about. But the good thing was the department was determined that would never happen again. So they had pulled together, and they were determined to put all that behind them. And they wanted to make sure that the mentoring of new professors was good. So they had actually set up a mentor committee. And this was before the university had gotten to the point of requiring such committees.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are rules and regulations as to what these mentor committees are supposed to do, but
mm-hmm.
the department had set that up even before then. And the my predecessor here was named Dave Stevenson,
mm-hmm.
and he actually had taught and started the groundwater program before I came. But he was part of the fallout of this unpleasantness, and he ended up leaving the department.
Mm-hmm.
But he went over to the extension,
mm-hmm.
So he was still available to me. So he was still part of this mentoring process. But the chair of my mentor committee was a professor who had just gotten tenure himself, who is a glacial geologist, who is one of the closer specialties in the department to me, and his
mm-hmm.
name is Dave Michelson. And he became a wonderful friend and mentor to this day. So I really view him as my getting me through tenure.
Mm-hmm.
Where was I?
Tenure process.
Oh, the tenure process, yeah. So I had a committee of three people. One was who was a fairly junior professor, and two senior professors.
Mm-hmm.
And there was actually never any doubt in my mind that I would get tenure. It was never stressful from that point for me.
Mm-hmm.
My husband was not at all convinced of it.
Huh.
So he was very apprehensive, but I never was.
Uh-huh.
I felt pretty sure it was going to go okay. And being an assistant professor was an extremely stressful experience. I was not a good teacher, so I had a terrible time trying to figure out how to teach, and getting all these terrible feedback from the students. So if I did have a worry, it was how the tenure committee was going to view that.
Now, could you get help from your colleagues in the teaching?
They tried, but you know, one of them gave me all his notes. And I tried to work with his notes, but it just didn't work. I could not fit myself into his course. So I eventually ended up just throwing all it out and starting all over. Another one said, well, you know, why don't you try jokes? Here's a book of jokes. I can't do that. So nobody could really help. And we didn't have the system in place where actually people would observe your teaching, which maybe they should have done, and maybe somebody actually watched me. And they suggested things, well, why don't you have it taped? And I'm like, God, no, I don't want to do that. I want to see myself. So I tried to figure it out, and I became okay. And I was good enough that I could get through the divisional committee standards. But I mean, that was always a worry for me. Stress, because I spent a lot of time on it, and yet the students didn't seem to appreciate it, didn't seem to recognize the time I was putting into it. Mm-hmm. So I still struggle actually with that to this day. But other than that, I felt the research was going very well, and that I thought I could get good outside letters, so I was never troubled by that. But you know, we do things like we'd work all the time. Charles and I would work all the time.
So he was going through the same thing.
No, he was not. He's not in tenure track.
That's right.
He never still isn't in tenure. Mm-hmm. He's a scientist track.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But he was, you know, interested. He's
sure.
Fairly, just for his own enlightenment. He likes chemistry, so he liked doing it. So, and since I was working all the time, he was working all the time too. But he eventually pulled us off into. He developed an interest. He'd always had an interest in opera. Both of us had an interest in opera. It was one of the things that drew us together. So he actually found a local opera group and became quite involved in it and kind of drew me into that. And then he would drag me off to Chicago for weekends to listen to opera. And while I'm listening to the opera, I'm thinking about all the stuff I should be doing back over here. But then we also discovered Door County, so we'd go to vacations at Door County. And we discovered New Orleans once when there was a conference, a Geological Society of America conference in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So we both actually went down there and just started to love New Orleans. So we started going to New Orleans and to Door County on vacations. And that kind of, he tried to, you know, get me away from all this. And he also was very supportive during this whole tenure process.
What about the publishing angle? No problem there.
No, I write easily.
I saw that on your door, so I figured that must be something that was very important to you.
It is, yeah. Right. I like to write. Mm-hmm. I liked getting papers out. That was a very satisfying thing. So when my master's students would finish, I'd take their stuff and I'd turn it into a paper, because I knew I couldn't rely on them to do it. So I do it myself, and they put their name on it, and we publish things. So I had no doubts that was, and my committee was assured, okay, yeah, this looks like it's going to be enough. You should be okay. So I was getting a lot of support and feedback, and I felt pretty good. And it went well.
It went okay.
Good. So I had no problem with the tenure.
You've talked a lot about this, but maybe there's something else you want to add about the culture of your department. Obviously, you've said collaborative work is encouraged.
Well, actually, yes and no. The university is known for interdisciplinary activity and doesn't put up any real barriers, but it turns out to be actually very hard to do, to do interdisciplinary work. It takes a lot of effort to do interdisciplinary work, and during the tenure process, it's discouraged, because it takes more time to do interdisciplinary work. And also, if you're working collaboratively with someone else, the question you get when someone looks at your tenure package is, well, how much did you do, and how much did the other person do?
Sure.
Is this really your work? Mm-hmm. So it's better if you just publish with your students. The key to getting tenure, even I think to this day, is that you publish work with your students. And then you could say, okay, the first author is my student.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, okay, well, of course, yes,
right.
yes.
Right.
But if the first author is my colleague over, especially if the colleague's a full professor,
mm-hmm.
they think, well, gosh, she didn't do anything on that. So it was better not to do interdisciplinary work. And this actually was kind of a problem for my my colleague Jean when she came here.
Mm-hmm.
She had been used to doing collaborative work, wanted to do collaborative work, but it was kind of discouraged until she got tenure.
Okay. Then it was
then it's
okay.
Okay. Yeah, then it's okay. Yeah, then it's okay. Yeah, then it's okay to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But but by then you're kind of in a you've set a pattern for your life. After the 6 years you've been working at tenure, you've
mm-hmm.
you've got your own little empire. You establish your own little empire and your own little students. So you know, there's really no motivation, incentive to do collaborative work unless it's intellectually stimulating.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it does, it's a lot of work to just learn somebody else's language, to coordinate with somebody else's schedule.
Mm-hmm.
The two collaborative relationships I've had that have worked out well were in writing books. I've written two textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was practically the first day I came to Madison. It was a geophysicist named Herb Wang, and who's now our associate dean.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been teaching the course in groundwater modeling before I came. And he had gotten the idea that a textbook was needed. So he said, let's write a textbook.
Mm.
So from almost day one, we started this collaborative working on a textbook, and it became Wang and Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a few years later, 10 years later, published another book, this time Anderson and Woosner. And Woosner was a PhD student from my predecessor, but I was on his committee.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Woosner eventually ended up at the University of Montana. And one day we were out at a conference and we were out at a restaurant, and he was saying, you know, you ought to write a book. There's a need for this second textbook. The Wang and Anderson talks about the theory part of modeling, but you need something that talks about the application of the models.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, let's write the book, Bill. I can't write it without you.
Mm-hmm.
So we did, and those have been wonderful collaborative experiences,
mm-hmm.
especially working with Bill. Bill and I really, really fill each other's needs. The things I lack, he has. And vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So we really form a great team. And we're working now on a revision of that textbook.
Now, what about the joint appointments? Are they based on collaborative work?
Well, yeah, the joint appointments are basically intellectually driven. There's no incentive for the department to go out and do this, and no pressure from the department to do this. But I was so impressed by the party there with all the water groups that I wanted to get to know these people.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to do that was through the Institute for Environmental Studies. So, and my predecessor, who by the way is named Dave Stevenson,
mm-hmm.
had been very active in water resources management program. So he had linked me up with the people there, and I started being an advisor in water resources management program through the Institute for Environmental Studies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then when the geological engineering program came along, that also was a natural link.
Sure.
Because I'd had students who wanted to master's students. I'd
mm-hmm.
had students apply who wanted to have a degree in hydrogeology, but they couldn't get into the geology department because they didn't have the field camp, they didn't have the mineralogy, they didn't have the petrology from a civil engineering department. So for some of those students, it would be easier to go through geological engineering and get the degree in geological engineering. So there was incentive for me
mm-hmm.
to join that program in order to, as a route, possible route for some
sure.
of my students. But also, I also immediately, again, almost from the first day here, had sought out the civil engineers because in groundwater work, you depend on courses in civil engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to send my students over there to civil engineering and got to know some of the guys over there in civil engineering, and they were all guys, still are all guys.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew all of them who were establishing this program in geological engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So that, again, was a kind of a personal link there
okay.
that personal incentive to be part of it.
Teaching, you've talked quite a bit about teaching, but can you talk a little bit, what courses have you taught?
Yeah, I've when I came, I started teaching the introductory course in hydrogeology. That was my staple course. And then there was also a course, it still is, a course in environmental geology, a 100 level course. So for the first 13 or so years here, I was teaching basically those two courses, plus a course in groundwater flow modeling, which is my specialty area. And then when Jean came, Jean, my colleague Jean Barr, she started teaching the some of those courses and gave me an opportunity then to establish a second graduate level specialty course in contaminant modeling, modeling contaminants in groundwater. So I now have those two courses, flow modeling and contaminant modeling. And then Jean has been picking up the and occasionally I had would fill in and teach part of the hydrogeology course, part or all of it, or part or all of the environmental geology course, until I started getting on these various administrative appointments, which we can talk about here in a minute.
Yeah.
But starting in 1993, I started down the track of various administrative appointments, which allowed me buyout from teaching.
Oh.
So I've kind of evolved into this situation now where I teach my two graduate level courses plus a seminar. All the way through, I should have mentioned, there's of course a seminar, a reading seminar for graduate students.
Now, so are there, you mentioned some students, are there other students who stand out in your mind that you know, you have special memories of?
Well, the students who are still here, Ken Bradbury at the State Geological Survey and Randy Hunt at the USGS are two of my closest colleagues who I still work with here in Wisconsin. And I get along with them very well, and they get along with each other very well. And I take pride in the fact that the students that I've trained, many of them have still stayed in the state, contributing to the Wisconsin idea, I think, in a really significant way.
Absolutely.
And all of these students know each other and like each other and can work with each other. So I think that fact has really done a lot to promote water resources in the state of Wisconsin. So that's one of the things I'm really proud of, is my students. So, but also I had a student, a Chinese student named Chunmyo Zhang. And he came to Wisconsin barely able to speak English, but he came with a fellowship from China, from the Chinese government. And he turned out to be one of the best students I've ever had. And he speaks English much, much better now, but he writes like a native speaker. It is amazing how he can write. And every time he would give me something, I would correct it, and he'd pay attention. Like some of the American students will say, "Oh, this is just her whim. This is some kind of stylistic craziness. We'll humor her, but we don't need to do this in the rest of our life." But he paid attention. He writes like I do now, and it's just he writes extremely well. He's written a textbook, co-author of a textbook, lead author of a textbook himself. And he's now internationally known.
Where is he?
He's at the University of Alabama, which actually has a really good program in environmental geology, and he's really established a good program in hydrogeology. But he also has a joint appointment now at Beijing University, and he spends part of his time there. Yes, yes, yes. He had some troubles there with the Chinese government right afterwards with the. He was supposed to go back to China, and he didn't go back right away. But he now patched all that up, and he now does go back, and he does have this point where he spends basically his summers, and will be spending his summers at in Beijing.
Let's see. Okay, we found out, I know where your research interests came from.
So let's talk about some of these administrative appointments here.
Right.
Yeah,
faculty governance committee work.
Right, right.
Activities.
In 1993, I was asked to be chair of the instructional programs at the Institute for Environmental Studies, which is now the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. And I hadn't been that active in IES before, but I was attracted to that idea. I thought it'd be kind of fun to learn more about the Institute and also to do some administration and also to get rid of my teaching load, because I got a buyout of my teaching load there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a half-time position. So at the Institute.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't remember how many courses I could drop that way. But I had a lighter teaching load, which
mm-hmm.
was appealing to do something else, because teaching has always been very difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
So that was actually quite an interesting experience, being chair of IES. I learned a lot about administrative work and also learned a lot about the Institute. And I met a lot of interesting people and students. So I did that for 3 years. And then right after that, I was asked to be on the university committee. Or asked if I would run for the university committee, and I got elected to the university committee. So I spent 3 years as a member of the university committee. And then right after that, I became chair of my own department for 3 years. And then after that, I was asked to be editor of the journal Groundwater. And that was sort of interesting, too. I would never have done that. I would never even thought of being, well, never would have thought of being chair of IES unless I was invited to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Never would have thought to be on the university committee unless somebody nominated me to do it. And never would have dreamed about editorial work. I just...
Really? Even though you enjoy the writing?
I enjoy the writing, and I'd actually been associate editors of various journals,
mm-hmm.
but I just never thought that being an editor of a journal was something I'd want to do, or
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have gone out of my way to apply for it.
Mm-hmm.
But the current editor called me up, and he said, "I think you'd be good at this. The journal really needs you. Why don't you consider it?" And so I thought, "Well, that sounds pretty interesting." So I decided to do it. I love it. Absolutely love it.
Well, good.
So I'm on my second term, still editor of this journal, mm-hmm. and I'm on my second term of that.
Now, you like the administrative work?
Not just because
it got you out of teaching, but...
I did enjoy the IES,
mm-hmm.
less so the departmental stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I did enjoy it for the first year or so, but I didn't... Toward the end, I was ready, really ready.
Mm-hmm.
And the tradition in our department, too, is basically you do it for 3 years and
yeah.
nobody ever repeats. And I see why. I mean, you really burned out, and everybody's sick of you, too.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really want to do it. People kept thinking after these two administrative roles that, oh, well, now she'll want to do something at the college level or go on, but I really didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
I never did. Throughout the, even as chair of IES, I never had any aspirations to do anything other than at the departmental level.
Mm-hmm.
Never wanted to be a dean or director of IES. I was invited to apply for the directorship of IES.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to do that.
Talk about your experience on the university committee.
Yes. All right. Are you sure you want to hear this?
Well, I are you sure you want to tell me?
This was the worst experience of my life.
Oh, no.
Possibly one of the worst, or maybe the worst experience of my life.
Oh, dear.
And the reason I told you that I had asked about the Oral History Project at one point in my life was I was once thinking that somebody ought to know about this, what happened to me on the university committee, and that it ought to be recorded somewhere in the department's archives. So I'm very happy, I think, to have an opportunity to comment on it. And it was a complicated situation. And once, just after it was all over, I had actually told somebody about it on a car ride. It was a 5-hour car ride, and I took the whole 5 hours to talk about this. So I won't do that now. I'm going to boil it down.
I have a second tape, so.
I'll boil it down. And to this day, I still am not exactly sure what it was all about or what all the motivations were. And I've thought about it a lot afterwards, and I still don't really understand it all.
Mm-hmm.
But I became on the committee in June of 1996 as a new member. Two new members. There's 6 members of the committee, and 2 come on each year.
Mm-hmm.
And the staff member with that committee is the secretary of the faculty,
mm-hmm.
and the staff member was and still is Dave Musoff,
mm-hmm.
who had been secretary of faculty at that time for only a year or so. He previously had been associate director of, or assistant director of the Nelson, the Institute for Environmental Studies.
Oh.
So I knew him when I was chair in IES. I'd met him and worked with him then. And we'd worked fine together at the time of the, when we were both at IES. But there had been some tension between us afterwards. And he was not thrilled with the fact that I was elected to the university committee.
Hmm.
Furthermore, when I got on the committee, I was appalled at some of the operating procedures. This is the most important committee in the university, I was told, and I believe that is true. It's the executive committee of the Faculty Senate. The secretary of the faculty would take notes during the course of our meetings. He would sit there and write things down, but there were never any minutes. There were no published minutes of this committee. And I was just astounded.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a push that we actually publish minutes, which we approve at our next meeting and have a chance to correct. And there were a bunch of these things, just things that I was just shocked at the way the committee was operating. Or the things that the committee was going to do. It seemed like I was always in the minority, and that I was always that I was being critical, and they soon decided they didn't like me on that committee.
Dear.
And they ended up, and I think part of this was some of the members of the committee were in the humanities and social sciences, and I wasn't the only scientist. But apparently the tradition that had evolved about how the committee operated was different from the kind of tradition that I'd operated in my own department, or that I operated under through all the other committees I'd ever served on outside the university here as a scientist, where you're very abrupt and frank and say what you mean, and you have to be forceful and aggressive, and I guess part of this, maybe being a woman in science, I developed some aggression tendencies or something, but something about what I was doing offended these social scientists and humanists, and the few scientists were there, apparently, also. And this was coupled with the fact that the secretary of the faculty was uneasy with me being there in the first place, and there were two women co-chairs on that committee, and the way they had divided it up is one would do it one semester and the other would do it the second semester, and the woman who was doing it the first semester, which is when all this started happening, the very first semester I was on the committee, was very insecure. At least in my perception, her name's Anne Devaney in the School of Education, and she appeared to me to be very insecure and unsure of herself, and I in retrospect now, I mean, I didn't realize it at the time, but they must have been taking this personally, thinking I was making personal attacks. Dave thinking I was attacking him, and Anne thinking I was making personal attacks on her, and I wasn't really, it wasn't that at all. I was concerned about the functioning of the committee. And maybe I probably did overdo it. But the reaction they took was that I had a personal conflict of interest and that I must resign from this committee. And they sent me, and I could see that something escalating. I knew something was up. I didn't know what they were planning. And about the same time, my mother, who had moved to Madison, my mother and father had moved to Madison in the interim from Buffalo, and my father had died, 93 he had died, and that same summer that I got on the university committee, I learned that my mother was dying of cancer and had 6 months to live. So I had to be absent from the committee one week because of my mother's situation. And during that time, they evidently voted that they were going to ask me to resign. And they sent me this letter saying that I had this personal conflict of interest, and that I was disrupting the functioning of the committee, and that I was doing all these things, unspecified, vague things. And I was just floored. I didn't know what to make of this. I didn't know what to do.
And you couldn't take it to the university committee.
Yeah, that's right. So I actually went to the then provost, who was John Wiley,
mm-hmm.
who was Dave Musoff's supervisor, and who was the person who actually did sit in on the university committee meetings occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
He would sometimes just sit in on a meeting just for interest, but he would often just come in because he had some business with the committee.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to him and asked for advice. And he said, why don't you go see Steve Pearson over in employee assistance office and see what he says. So this had actually happened. I knew something was going on because actually early on in this whole thing, I had indications from Dave and from Ann that they were not happy with me. And I didn't know where that was going, but it didn't look good. So at that point, I had asked John for advice. And so early on in this, I hooked up with Steve Pearson. So by the time I got this letter asking me to resign, I had actually been talking with Steve for several weeks. And so I took the letter to him, and I said, what do I do? And he said, well, this is vague, unsubstantiated allegations. What you do is you write them a letter back and say, okay, when exactly did I do such and such? At what time and occasion did I disrupt this? And when did I give this impression? And I can't remember all the details of this letter, but it was just all these page and a half of unsubstantiated things that I did. So he said, pin them down and say, exactly when did I do all this stuff? So I spent like the whole weekend with my husband, who was extremely supportive through this whole thing now, writing a letter asking them these questions. And they never responded to it. I sent them a letter and they never responded to it. But this went on. And I probably should have gone through the timing here in order to get this on oral history, but it's so painful sometimes. I didn't want to dig up all my correspondence. But this thing went on all summer. It happened very quickly after I got onto the university committee. So it was through the summer and through the early fall semester, they kept trying to figure out how to get me to resign. And there was these veiled threats. There was incredible pressure and intimidation. They threatened and eventually did have a closed session of the Faculty Senate in which they were going to expose me in front of the Senate. To what, I don't know, but so we were sitting there at the Senate meeting, and I'm all ready for this to happen. I don't know what's going to happen, but then the chair of the university committee gets up and says, well, we've decided to defer this at this point in time. We're not going to do it today. And like my husband said, it's like holding someone in prison and saying, okay, now we're going to shoot you. And then, okay, no, now we're not going to shoot you. And it was just like that kind of, and meanwhile, my mother's dying of cancer. My husband, bless his heart, basically took over the care of my mother, figuring out how to mastermind that, and also was extremely supportive to me. Steve Pearson was incredibly supportive as well. And also, by this time, I decided I needed a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I was sure I was not going to resign. My husband said, absolutely not. You can't resign now. You don't know what you've done. Mm-hmm. And if you resign, it looked like you will have done something. So we got, I had never met Gordon Baldwin before, but I'd heard of him.
Hmm.
So contacted him, and he agreed to help me pro bono. And he said, absolutely, no reason to resign. And you're right, and I'll stick with you in this. There's nothing here. And if they want to, they should bring formal charges through FP&P. So eventually they did get to the point where the two women chairs decided they couldn't handle it on their own. So they contacted the two former chairs of the university committee. So the two women chairs who were going after me were Ann Devaney and Evelyn Howell. And then they contacted Jim Donnelly and Bill Reznikoff, were the two former chairs of the university committee. So the four of them, and we had meetings, which the four chairs there, well, I guess Ann Devaney had rotated off at that point. I guess by that time she had rotated off that summer. They were basically going after me, threatening all this stuff. And eventually there was a closed session of the Faculty Senate in which Jim Donnelly got up and started making all these statements. And Gordon Baldwin had warned him that he had to be careful about libel. So he made the statements in such a vague manner, without mentioning my name, that nobody could figure out what he was talking about. And Gordon Baldwin basically said, there's nothing here, I suggest we go home. I know of this, I know all the details of this, and I can assure you there's been nothing, no legal action. And Bernice Duran, who I didn't know, got up basically and said to Jim Donnelly, I'm really offended that you brought this here in front of the Senate. I think this is outrageous what you're doing, and everything just, Jim turned red in the face, and the whole thing dissipated. But it wasn't over even then. Then the committee met again, and one of the committee members, the chairs were about ready to give up at that point. So Evelyn looked at me, she said, well, you're not gonna resign, are you? No, I'm not gonna resign. So okay, then they were ready to go on, but one of the members of the committee, is in African American studies, Ralston, that's his first name. He wrote me a letter saying that if I didn't resign from the committee now, that he would expose me, that he would resign. And that in resigning, when anybody asked him why he would resign, he would say it was because of me. So I wrote him a letter saying there's no need for you to resign, there's no need for me to resign, let's just put this whole thing behind us, and I'm not gonna resign. And he eventually saw the truth in all this, and he didn't resign either. And we somehow managed to patch it all together and struggle through the whole next year. Finally, most of them were gone, and a whole new crew came on, and everything finally quieted down, and I ended up my term, my three-year term. But and the other thing is, after this historic meeting at the Senate, which was early November, the meetings are always on a Monday, so that was the Monday early May, November 2nd. November 3rd, my mother died. So suddenly all these things were over at the Senate meeting. But that was just a horrendous, horrendous experience. And it used up a tremendous amount of energy, of people's time and effort in the university committee. And I still don't understand what was the motivation. Mm-hmm. Why were they so eager to get rid of me? I still puzzle on that. Mm-hmm. But it was, I think, a shameful period in faculty governance. And of course, if you interviewed all these people I've named, I'm sure they'd all have their own different take on all this. But nevertheless, I did last them out, and I did stay on the committee, and I think I was able to contribute. I wasn't obviously as effective as I would have liked to have been, because there was this cloud hanging over me the whole time. But at least I got them to publish minutes, which they, I think, still do. Okay. And there were a few other things I was able to contribute to the committee. And I gained enormous insights into what happens, I think, to faculty members who get on the university committee. Basically, good people get corrupted in some way, I'm convinced now. And there was this gang mentality, or group mentality, that everything had to be a consensus, and anybody who didn't buy into the consensus didn't belong on the committee. And so I don't know whether that's still true, but that was certainly the whole time I was there. It was, if you were, you know, it didn't bother me that much that I was always in the minority, but it seemed to bother them, mm-hmm. that there was always someone who didn't agree with the consensus. Mm-hmm. So they're great. I have it on record.
You have it on record. Quite an experience. Well, let's talk about something pleasant. We'll go back to the climate for women here, but talk about the professional organizations to which you belong, and about any honors and awards that you've received. And I know there's some of those.
Okay. Actually, could I mention just one other committee experience?
Yes.
I was on the Physical Science Divisional Committee, and that was before the University Committee experience. And that was quite a good experience, I should say. So I've not had completely negative experiences with university service. The physical science division committee was quite a wonderful experience, and I think I was the first woman ever to be on that committee.
Mm. Now, was that an elected position too?
That was elected as well, right. And that it was with a group of scientists, which maybe was helpful there. We all spoke the same language at least. But that gave me great insights into the tenure process, how people are reviewed for tenure, and also gave me an opportunity to go out and look at some of the other departments. The committee visits with different departments who have tenure cases under consideration.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to learn a lot about how other science departments work. And I had a very good experience with the Physical Science Divisional Committee.
Mm-hmm.
But the professional work, I was president of the American Geophysical Union section of hydrology. So I did that first president-elect and then served as president, and that was a good experience as well.
Mm-hmm.
Got to know a little bit about other sections of hydrology besides groundwater. There's surface water and soil water and atmospheric water, and they're all under this section of hydrology in AGU. So that was quite interesting to meet people from all these different backgrounds, and gave me some insight into how a professional society works, which was quite valuable. And I've also been on the so-called Council for the Geological Society of America.
Mm.
That wasn't quite as much fun. And there was the horrendous personnel issue erupted while I was on that council. And I was fortunately not part of that, but I was a member of the council trying to resolve it. And that took up a lot of the committee's time trying to wrestle with that.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. So in terms of awards, I've really been fortunate in winning quite a few of these society awards. One of the first was through the National Groundwater Association. Was a so-called Hubbard Award, and then I've won several others, the so-called Meinzer Award with the Geological Society of America. And that one in particular, the Meinzer Award, was really quite special to me because it's given by colleagues in hydrogeology. You're voted on by colleagues in hydrogeology as having a best collection of papers in a certain period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite a nice award,
yes.
Very very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And the other memorable one was being elected to fellowship in the American Geophysical Union, and that's a very elite group of people, and they also have very nice ceremony, black tie, and very formal, and that was quite special too.
Mm-hmm. When was that?
We'll get it on my resume here. Let's see. Fellow was 1999.
Oh.
Fellow of American Geophysical Union. And the Meinzer Award was the year before that, 1998.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then, of course, in UW, my own colleagues here in the department nominated me for the first mid-career award.
Oh, yeah.
That I got that in 1995. And that was a real surprise and a big thrill. Especially if you're recognized in-house. I think it's really nice, really meaningful when your colleagues here at the university recognize you.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there one that you're forgetting?
Yes, and then, of course, the recent one, the most recent one, the election to the National Academy of Engineering. And I was totally stunned by that. I never, in my wildest dreams, expected that. Now, I've always sort of thought, well, maybe it's possible one day I'll win such and such an award or this award, but National Academy of Engineering was not even in the ballpark.
Well, how does that happen?
Well, I learned afterwards, how it happened. Jean actually was chair of the department now, and she said, so and so actually asked for your resume a while back, so I knew something was up. And this process is completely secret. I'm not supposed to know who nominated me.
She
tipped me off. And of course, as soon as I got elected, I started looking in the directory they sent me to see who it was I knew who was in there. So I actually sent an email to the people I thought might be responsible, and one of them being the person Gene had alerted me to, and he fessed up and said,
oh,
yes, I did. And by the way, here are the other people who supported your nomination. So I got to, and I was just stunned, because these men, these four men, were gods. They're just the gods of higher geology, to two of them in particular. And I just being nominated by those individuals in particular, it was just astonishing to me. But the way it works is that you have to be nominated by someone who's already a member, and people who are already members have to support the nomination.
I see.
And you need at least three people who are writing supporting letters for you,
mm-hmm.
the nominator and two others, and it's better if you actually have a third one, for a total of four. And then your name is posted on the National Academy website, when only the members can access,
mm-hmm.
and then anybody can look at that, and they decide to say something about you. Either this person is not worthy, or
mm-hmm.
they can support it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get through all of that, Then there's a committee who reviews everybody's nomination. Each section, I learned there are sections in the National Academy of Engineering,
mm-hmm.
12 different sections, and each section puts forward members to the membership committee, and then the membership committee chooses a certain number of them. And it is apparently limited. There are around 2,000 members, and I think they try to keep the membership at around 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
The average age is 71. So they lose a few members each year,
right.
And they elect around 80 each year, and 4% are women.
Well, congratulations.
Yes,
that's
thank
fantastic.
You, thank you. Yeah, I can still hardly believe it.
So is there a ceremony in
Washington?
Yes,
in October, mm-hmm. October 15th, there is a ceremony in Washington at the National Academy building, where I guess there's a medal ceremony. There's also a black tie formal dinner. And a brunch, and they also have a technical meeting and orientation at that time. So it's like a two or three day event,
mm-hmm.
Saturday, Sunday, Monday in October.
And then do they have annual meetings?
Yes, they do. They do meet annually, apparently, around in October for technical meetings. And also one of the big things, almost as soon as they got elected, I'm getting email messages about election of new members. One of the big things is election of new members.
Sure.
And also I had served on committees with the National Research Council, which is the
mm-hmm.
operating unit of the National Academy of Science and the National Academy of Engineering. And just as a professor, I had served on a number of these committees.
Mm-hmm.
And the function of the committee is to advise various agencies of the federal government on certain problems. And each of these committees, they like to have either a member from the National Academy of Engineering or National Academy of Science sit on each of the National Research Council committees. So I expect that in the future I'll get asked
mm-hmm.
to be on more of these committees,
right.
as the representative from the academies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great.
And you do pay dues, the other thing that
oh.
people don't know, $200 a year dues.
Uh-huh.
The first year dues are waived, but after, in order to remain an active member, you're supposed to pay the dues.
Okay. What do they use the money for? Just to have their conferences?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe to buy the medals, pay for the dinners.
Yeah, sure.
And you do have to pay all your own expenses to get there, obviously.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure what they use the money for.
That's great.
Maybe I'll find out.
Yeah. I would like you to talk a little bit about the climate for women here. It sounds as though you have a very supportive department and had from the beginning. But what, I don't know how you can answer this, but what about campus-wide? What you said about the university committee doesn't sound like it has anything to do